Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Sean Daly. Mr. Daly was convicted of several sexual offenses in the Superior Court and sentenced to a lengthy term of imprisonment. There were three issues raised on appeal in this case. I'm going to try to address them seriatim, each of them. The first issue says concerns and issues as raised by the defense at trial concerning the foundation for the admission of what is called in the vernacular a 3507 statement. It's essentially an out-of-court hearsay statement. It says by a witness. The witness, the complainant in this case, was a child who was 5 years old at the time of the alleged offense, and she was 7 years old at the time of trial. She had been, as most complainants in this situation are, she had been taken to the Child Advocacy Center at the AI DuPont Hospital, where there are professional staff who interview child victims in an environment that they believe is conducive to getting an explanation as to what had occurred to the child. Now, the state introduced a 3507 statement in this case, and it was a videotape of the child's statements as at the hospital, and it was of extensive duration. I think it was around 40, 47 minutes, and the state, the defense objected to it on the grounds that there wasn't a sufficient foundation as required under 3507 in the Keyes case and its progeny. The defense claimed that the statement did not touch upon, says, the events perceived in the out-of-court statement itself. Essentially, I guess it means the witness's testimony must touch upon the res geste of the offense and also address the circumstances under which the out-of-court hearsay statement was given to someone else, which will be related. Well, here it wasn't necessarily a statement given to someone else. There are differences in the cases. Some are videotaped. Some are non-videotaped, non-recorded statements.
Well, here it was videotaped. Correct?
Yes, sir, it was.
Does that make a difference? I mean, I'm not sure, like you, what the phrase from Keyes touched on the events perceived or heard and the out-of-court statement itself means in light of the complaining witness's apparent inability to confirm she'd given a statement. But there is a videotape of her giving it.
Yes, sir. I can't answer that question conclusively. I can acknowledge.
Well, how do you distinguish Felke? You know, my recollection of Felke is that it involved a witness who came as close to saying nothing as possible. And notwithstanding that, the 3507 statement was admitted. And clearly, Felke followed and applied Keyes.
Mm-hmm. In Felke, there was, as I recall, says an explanation by the child about the bad things her daddy did to her. And that was in the courtroom during her, says, direct testimony. One of the problems in this case, insofar as the 3507 statement, is that initially back in 1975, the court was concerned, I think it was addressed in the Hutchins case, the state's practice at that time was essentially to, you know, use this and punt to the defense. They'd say, okay, let's play the statement, or here's the police officer's statement. Now, we have no questions of the witness. You must testify. And that's what developed the requirement the complainant testify concerning, says the offense itself and the out-of-court statement. In this, it's almost as if the state is back at that situation where the state's...
Are you proposing a rule that if the declarant, A, doesn't remember the events, and B, doesn't remember giving the statement, that statement has to be excluded?
Well,
if that's not your rule, what is your rule for reading of 3507?
Well, 3507 is... There is not a confrontation problem with that. It says we know a federal confrontation problem, but 3507 is a different animal. It's a statute that's been passed that that permits the admissions of this hearsay evidence. And in this case, there was even a comment, says, by the prosecutor to the effect that the child has testified very haltingly concerning the offense, and the prosecutor has made a statement to the effect that, well, that wraps it up under 3507. You know, phew, that's it. And we suggest that the problem here is, in this case, it's not enough to make a fleeting, for a witness, a child, to make a fleeting reference to what occurred to her. Did something bad happen to you? Yes. Yeah. Did Daddy do something bad to you? Yes. Okay, that wraps it up for 3507.
Fair to say that the origins of 3507 were pretty firmly rooted in the concept of the turncoat witness and the frustration that the state would face if someone who gave him a statement that led to probable cause, arrest, indictment, preparation for trial, suddenly at trial denied that they knew anything about the event, denied that they'd even made the statement, which in its origins was usually either taped on an audio tape or just the police officer's best recollection typed up, sometimes signed, sometimes not signed. And we've now gotten to the point where it's become such a useful tool in other prosecutions, such as prosecutions when the complaining witness is very young, very impressionable, that it's facilitates prosecution in a much broader circumstance than it was originally intended to govern. But you still fall back to the rule that Vice Chancellor Noble just expressed some concern about. If we had a bright line rule, then we'd be back to where we started, where we'd have the turncoat witness problem again, that this was designed to deal with in the first place. That's a long-winded statement, more than a question, but where do we find ourselves today with the Keyes rule and the other rules? I recall at least one case, though naturally I can't remember the name of it, where the witness took the stand and had amnesia, couldn't remember the event itself, didn't remember having given a statement, claimed amnesia was the reason, and the court said, that's fine, you can cross-examine a person who doesn't remember anything effectively.
Yes.
Where are we going with this? It's totally out of control.
That's where the Constitution.
How do we rein it in?
That witness was a correctional officer who was knocked unconscious by the defendant, and that was the United States case, and why there's not much of a constitutional argument here, that our argument does rely on 3507. Your Honor is correct. I had a discussion with the Superior Court judge who was in the Attorney General's office at the time that the statute was enacted. Of course, there was no statutory history for it, but Judge Hurley's recollection was that it was directed towards the witness who was influenced by the Fagan, says at trial, and what happened was police officers would get statements from young youths, et cetera, and then the youths would contradict their statement in the courtroom or say they never gave a statement. And that was the unofficial origin of 3507. So now it is being used in a broader context. And what we'd suggest is that it was misused or abused in this case, because what we had is a situation whereby the state more or less rested or stopped with its examinations as of the witness after getting only the slightest, after reaching only the slightest discussion of the offense that allegedly occurred. Okay,
well,
that wraps it up for 35.
That brings us back to Vice Chancellor Noble's question, which you know, we must have an answer to if we're to address your argument, and that is, what is the rule that you're contending that we must adopt in order for there to be an adequate foundation for a 3507 statement?
Well, I'd suggest that the rule in this case is that the state should be required to do more than just get a reference to the original offense from the witness.
Do more in what sense? Do what?
Fully question, says, attempt to question, says the complainant, concerning what had occurred to her.
And if the complainant does not remember, then is the statement admissible or not?
That may be a different, that could be a different situation. But under these circumstances, there wasn't a challenge or an exercise whereby the witness was brought on to discuss the alleged offense against her.
What do we have? We know we have the videotaped statement, and the state seemed to ask the victim, And do you remember being in a room with stuffed animals? And the witness said yes. Is there any other connection between the testimony in the courtroom and the statement?
No. The witness said that. The trial court relied on that to establish the second part of the foundation, that the testimony addressed the out-of-court statement itself, or that there be a nexus with the out-of-court statement itself.
Well, here, when we do have a taped statement, as opposed to some other type of 3507 statement where the trier of fact can, you know, decide if the victim is really the person on the taped statement, what should the state really do, you know, in addition to having the witness available and subject to cross-examination? As Justice Ridgely said, if you make a couple of inquiries and the victim says, listen, I don't remember a thing, that's me on the tape, but I don't remember anything that happened and I don't remember what I said, what else would the state need to do to get the tape in?
Let's say, to fully explore the situation with, says the witness itself, an example that popped into my mind, as Your Honor asked the question, it may be a poor one. Let's say, for instance, put it in another situation. This is the attempted assassination of President Reagan and the shooting of, says Mr. Brady. Let's say the police or Secret Service officers investigated and interviewed a number of Secret Service officers for statements as to what they had seen, taken videotapes of them. And come to trial, they have videotapes of the witnesses against Mr. Hinckley, and they say, okay, Secret Service officer so-and-so, were you there? Yes. Did you give a statement to your fellow Secret Service officer with the videotape? Did you describe what occurred, what you had seen that day? Yes. Did you, and do you remember giving a videotape statement? Yes. Okay. Defense, we're going to play the tape. It's your witness.
Let's assume that all those questions are asked and all the answers are no. Then what?
Then
the statement goes in anyway, doesn't it?
Yes, sir, it does.
And how does this case, where you have a videotape statement, differ? That is, even if the questions that you contend should have been asked were asked, is there any scenario under which this tape wouldn't go in?
It's a scenario that's different for the jury to appraise, because the jury may realize under circumstances, there's a difference between a jury having information or testimony to the effect that the complainant has amnesia and there's a justification for their not remembering versus requiring the defense to explore the offense in the courtroom. The defense can't cross-examine the videotape. The defense has to cross-examine, says the witness, in the courtroom.
It seems intuitive that when there's a videotape, it sort of takes out of issue whether the statement was given or not. But the trial judge really nailed the important questions here when the trial judge says to the state, there's been no questions at all about the fact that she was interviewed. Did she tell the truth during that interview? It seems, as I recall the facts here, she never saw the videotape even in the courtroom and confirmed in front of the jury, who's testing her credibility after all, yes, that is me in the videotape. It is not. I do or do not remember giving it. And most importantly, I did or did not tell the truth during that interview. She was never given the opportunity to confirm or deny any of that, which seems fundamentally essential to the jury's evaluation of her testimony on the stand, their evaluation of her testimony in the videotape, should it ultimately come in. So forget about whether it's a test for whether it comes in or not. Shouldn't the jury have that information?
We believe that is a problem in that the jury should be able to assess the credibility of the witness in the courtroom based upon some substantive testimony.
And were any of the questions the Chief Justice just asked by the defense attorney?
There were a few questions along the lines of did you – and this was the –
Well, she answered the state's inquiry that she didn't recall talking about the event to anyone other than her mother.
Yes. She didn't recall, says the tape, yes. And Mr. Fasciola, it's at 840. Any of the things that are talked about in that tape, do you remember any of them? I can't remember. So you can't remember any of the things that were talked about in the tape itself? No. And then Mr. Roberts said, but this was after her original direct testimony that where she hardly said anything.
So was the sequence as follows? When did the tape come in? Before her cross-examination or after?
The tape was played between her, after her direct examination and prior to her cross-examination.
So the judge made a determination based on the record we had before us that the tape was admissible under 3507. And
yes.
So we have her direct testimony in the courtroom plus the tape. Then she subjected to cross-examination.
Yes. And that was the only point where there was a questioning or some answering concerning the substantive offenses themselves. And that came after the introduction of the tape itself. And insofar as the introduction of the tape, one of the things that I couldn't resolve is that tape was marked as, it's referred to as State's Exhibit 2. I can't determine from, maybe I missed something, I can't determine that it went back to the jury or not, if the jury was played. But nonetheless, it didn't come in as a court exhibit. It's referred to as State's Exhibit 2 on A33. And if that had been played for the jury had it to play in the jury room, I think it would have been violation of Flannery since there was no...
Well, the mere fact it's called Exhibit Number 2 suggests to me that it went back to the jury room. All exhibits go back to the jury room. Parties mark items for identification, then they're transformed as if by magic by the judge into an actual exhibit when he rules or she rules that they are admitted, correct? Has that practice changed?
This was apparently, not that I know of, Your Honor, but apparently in this context it was identified and stipulated to as Exhibit 2.
Well, that answers Flannery then, doesn't it?
That it went back to the jury room. It was available to be played. And that gives a disproportionate emphasis to the out-of-court statement.
But if it's stipulated to, that takes it out of Flannery concerns.
It was stipulated that it was an exhibit, well, State's Exhibit 2.
That's it. There endeth that lesson.
As to the, there's another issue, as raised by the defense, and that was the issue concerning the cross-examination or the potential cross-examination of the defendant himself. The defendant, apparently from his discussions with his attorney, was considering, says, taking the witness stand in his own defense. And it was raised the question of whether some prior conduct involving a prior sexual offense, an unlawful sexual intercourse third degree, would be relevant and admissible in his cross-examination. There was discussion, it's at 831, says, of the appendix, but raised by, says, defense counsel to the effect that defense counsel wanted to know whether the prior offense of unlawful sexual intercourse third degree would be inquired upon by the state. Now, immediately preceding this, the state had asked to cross-examine the grandmother of the child concerning a prior criminal impersonation conviction. Now, that could be admissible for impeachment under Rule of Evidence 609, but the prosecutor wanted to cross-examine her concerning the substance or the events of that prior criminal impersonation where the grandmother allegedly, when her son was accused of a sex offense, she called in the police and pretended to be the victim and said, let's forget about it. And so the grandmother was convicted of criminal impersonation. Now, the prosecution wanted to get into the actual facts that's involved with that. The court ruled that it was not, says admissible, but immediately after that, the question arose concerning cross-examining the defendant concerning the prior unlawful sexual intercourse third-degree conviction. The defense wanted to know whether the state was going to go into the offense itself. Now, there's some ambiguity, says there, insofar as whether we were talking about or everybody was talking about impeachment by prior conviction under Rule 609 or impeachment simply by other bad character evidence.
Is that an application of some kind or a motion? The defense wanted to know. The defense probably would like to know a lot of things, but that doesn't make it a motion in limine, does it?
Well, the defense made it clear that it wanted this evidence out, the character evidence, the bad character evidence, and if not, it would chill the defendant's ability to, you know, testify in his own behalf. Now, it wasn't raised as a 609 issue. If it would have been altogether different if it had been clear that the state only sought impeachment by the prior conviction, felony conviction of unlawful sexual intercourse, third degree. But that wasn't clear, and the defense was afraid that what would happen was it opened up a Pandora's box of questioning about his prior sexual offense against an underage person. And the court didn't answer the question. And, you know, an answer after the defendant testifies or waives his right not to testify isn't very helpful. So this was the appropriate time, we believe, to raise it this in limine. Just like under 609, it's no different.
But there was no motion in limine, was there?
I believe there was, Your Honor. It's at A31, Mr. Fasciola, Your Honor, there will be consideration tomorrow of whether my client's going to testify. I may as well bring this up at this moment. He has a prior conviction for lawful sexual intercourse in the third degree, a different set of facts than this. But I'm not clear whether or not the state will be able to go into the actual facts of that one. That one is going to be a probative versus prejudice type of analysis. It was a relationship with a girl. The court, it would be, I think, difficult for the court not to find that a prior sexual offense is not probative of the charges that are here. Obviously, it's prejudicial, but I think that one is being charged with another sex offense. Its probative value would outweigh any prejudice that would occur. So the fact that he has a prior conviction for that, I think, would be an appropriate area of inquiry for the state. So that's something you may want to talk to him about and assess that risk. In a sense, the court is telegraphing or telling him if he takes the stand, it's almost as if like says, Mr. Getz, if you take the stand, you know what? The state's going to be able to bring in these alleged other offenses against you, even though they're uncharged. And that's a different situation than under 609. The court has ruled before in the Fennell case, as the state pointed out, that if the defendant does not take the stand and testify under 609, they've waived it. But we contend that this is an altogether different situation where the defendant just didn't face the potential prejudice by a 609, by impeachment under 609, is more well-defined and accessible from the defense perspective than this. You really have to guess as to how damaging it can be. But once the damage has been done, the damage has been done.
And what's the distinction you see between this and 609?
You would know under 609 that you can assess. It's almost like you know that, well, the defendant's going to be impeached by a prior robbery second conviction, and that's it. Or the defendant's going to be impeached by a prior unlawful sexual intercourse third degree conviction, and that's it. It's easier to deal with that or assess the potential prejudice in view of the state's case, your own case there, than trying to determine what's going to fall on you from above if the state gets an opportunity to cross-examine your client concerning the evidence in a prior sexual offense. That the prejudice there is far more difficult to ascertain. It's wholly speculative. When you're dealing with a 609 conviction, you're dealing with something tangible, one conviction, two convictions. Is it a dishonesty conviction? Is it a felony? Thank you, Your Honor.
Did you have a question?
I did. If it's wholly speculative, how can the trial judge assess it in advance of the testimony?
By a the trial judge can assess in advance of the testimony by asking, says the parties, well, what is it? What do you propose to do? What do you propose to offer? What's the evidence? It's in limine. It's an offer of proof. And that's how the says the court would make its exercise of discretion, based upon the offer of proof.
And shouldn't the defense attorney have insisted upon that?
We submit he got his ruling, says here. Thank you.
You do know you used up all your rebuttal?
Yes, sir, I know. Yes, okay. I will not have any rebuttal. I understand that.
May it please the court, James Wakely on behalf of the state. In the more than 30 years that 3507 has been on the books in Delaware, this court has refined and defined what is required before admitting a 3507 statement. There are four requirements. First, the witness must be an in-court witness and be subject to cross-examination. As both this court and the United States Supreme Court have found, there is no guarantee as to the quality of that cross-examination, and there is no guarantee that you will be able to realize anything of value out of the cross-examination. The second requirement is that the direct examination must touch on both the events perceived and the out-of-court statement itself. Here, the testimony of Mr. Daly's victim did indeed touch on the events perceived. She testified about what her father had done to her, testified perhaps not to the degree desired by Mr. Daly or, in fact, by the state, but did indeed testify to specific acts committed by her abuser against her. And that's found in A26, 27 of the appendix. The third requirement is that the statement must have been given voluntarily, and there has been no question here that the statement was given voluntarily. And for the fourth requirement is that the witness must be in court at the time her statement is played. And again, there does not appear to be any issue of whether the victim was present in the courtroom at the time the statement is played.
Does 3513B1 change all that under circumstances where the witness whose statement is sought to be introduced is less than 11 years old?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm unfamiliar with the statute.
Well, here's what the statute says, and there's one phrase I want to ask you about. And if my colleagues agree, I would give your fellow counsel, Mr. Donald, the opportunity to respond to this question. This statute at least appears to me to replace the four foundational requirements under 3507 when the child is witness is less than 11. It says an out-of-court statement will be admitted if, one, the child is present, two, the child's testimony touches upon the event, and three, is subject to cross-examination, rendering such prior statement admissible under 3507. Now, who the clever person was that added that phrase and confused matters, I don't know. But is it saying that there are now only three requirements? The child is present, the testimony touches upon the event, and the child is subject to cross-examination, that renders it admissible as if it were a 3507 statement, or does it say those three factors, but 3507 in its entirety still applies? It would seem redundant if that were the case, but can you help me out with that? Because it tends to say there's less of an expectation of someone under 11 years of age to understand the significance of having given a statement. Perhaps no longer has to testify that I, in fact, gave the statement. I, in fact, was telling the truth when I gave the statement. It's simply sufficient that someone younger than 11 can remember any of the events that touch upon what's contained in the statement and is there to be cross-examined.
Well,
what do you think about that statute, and does it apply to this case?
First of all, Your Honor, I must apologize. I haven't had an opportunity to consider this, and I may not be fully prepared to address the court's question at this time. If the court would like a further analysis, I'd be happy to do a supplemental memoranda. I would say that the statute, as you've read it to me, does appear to apply in this case. It does, however, appear to be basically the same factors as 3507, conflating the must be present in court with the must be present at the time her statement is played.
Well, to the extent it's relevant in a case like this where we have a videotape, which pretty much confirms that an earlier statement took place, it seems to eliminate any questions necessary about did you give the earlier statement and were you telling the truth in that statement, which is impliedly present in some of our other case law when you're dealing with oral statements or you're dealing with handwritten statements or you're dealing with the police officer's recollection noted in a police report, all those other dozens of variables that we've seen in the past. But I understand that you aren't ready to address that today, but the corresponding question is, even under this statute, it seems that the trial judge should make findings that these elements are present in the record or they are not. And I searched the record in vain to find actual findings by the trial judge that show attention to 3507 or 3513B1 in any way that allows us to determine what he thought the facts were and why he admitted the statement. There's just no finding about any of the foundational elements at all. Why? Well,
first, it's clear that she testifies about what happened to her.
Well, she makes one statement, and if my dad tried to touch me there with his wee-wee is multiple comments about all the events that took place. I'm missing something. But that's my understanding of all she testified to on direct before that statement came in that touched upon the event. Am I wrong about that?
If you will grant me a moment, Your Honor, I apologize.
On A27... And then on A28, the trial judge begins to say, well, you haven't asked about the fact she was interviewed. You haven't asked about whether she told the truth when she was interviewed. And then the only response she says is, the only person I ever talked to was my mother.
Yes, sir. That is a correct.
Where does he make his findings about what's sufficient for the foundational elements, either four under 3507 or three under 3513B1?
Well, there's a further colloquy between the judge and the victim and between Mr. Roberts and the victim to delve more into the circumstances of the statement.
Mike, I thought the case law made it clear the judge has to make a finding that the statement was voluntary, the judge has to make a finding that the foundational elements are present, and then and only then the statement comes in before the jury and ultimately gets into the jury room. Tell me the transcript page where that took place.
I believe it's in here. If you will grant me just
a
moment,
helpful,
I will.
Because I've been unable to find it.
I believe there's a point, Your Honor, after the discussion, I don't want to occupy too much time searching the record for it at this moment.
Representation to me is that if I look further, I will indeed find where the judge has made it an express factual finding on each of the foundational elements of 3507 and the fact that the statement was voluntarily given at the time it was given.
There's no, I will represent to you, there is no statement by the judge as to each of the four factors. There is a point where Judge Carpenter says, I'm satisfied that the foundation has been laid for 3507.
Okay, so we're supposed to pour through the record and find out what it was that satisfied him.
It's that statement comes at the conclusion of a discussion between Mr. Roberts and the victim about the questioning by Mr. Roberts of the victim whether she went to a big room with a giraffe and spoke to a woman about this.
Okay, so even if he didn't articulate the points, if we go through the record and surmise that we had been there at the time, we could have made those findings.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it now becomes our job to do so.
Your Honor, I would be happy to point it out. I just cannot do it at this particular moment. And the judge's findings are supported by this court's prior holdings in a variety of other cases, including the two Johnson cases, Larry Johnson and Marion Johnson, where the victim did not recall giving the statement at all. Neither of those cases. In Larry Johnson, which is a 2005 case, the police officer did not remember speaking to the police officer, and this court affirmed the decision to admit the statement under Section 107 there. In the much older case, which I believe was considered contemporaneously with Keyes, Marion Johnson, again, the victim barely testified about what had happened, did not remember giving the statements, in fact, did not remember the entire period of time during which she was interviewed. And again, the court affirmed the decision to admit the statement under 3507.
So in that circumstance, it's impossible for a person, assuming that testimony is true, to testify as to the truthfulness of the statement.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, someone cannot testify to the truthfulness of a statement that they do not recall making. And here, it's clear she does not remember giving the statement. The fact is that the question about the truthfulness of the statement, as Justice Jacobs pointed out, the answer is largely irrelevant to the admissibility of the statement. We've had cases, Flannery, for instance, where the witness specifically says, I lied in that statement, and the statement is nonetheless admissible. It goes to the weight the evidence is given. Here she testified, I don't remember giving the statement. And again, that consideration goes into the weight that the statement is given by the jury. Moving on now to Mr. Daly's second argument, this court has been very clear in both Walker and Fennell, as well as the United States Supreme Court in Luce, that if defendant does not testify, they don't get to make this argument. There's an insufficient record to decide this issue on that basis. We don't know whether, and it was recognized by this court, the court cannot assume that Daly's decision to decline to testify was attributable solely to the trial judge's in limine motion in Walker. Similar line of thought was found in Fennell. And in both of those cases, the court was put on notice ahead of time as to what the testimony would be, what the subject of cross-examination, what the prior conviction was. Here, the judge made
he gave a non-committal advisory opinion. The argument is that has a chilling effect on someone's exercise of their right to testify or not to testify. Why didn't he just say, the issue isn't right, I'll decide it when it comes before me?
That perhaps would have been a more advisable tack to take. However, given the presentation that he was given, it did not appear Mr. Roberts was either present or given an opportunity to respond. It appeared off the cuff at the time. It was a matter of housekeeping in between sessions of the court. It was, what do you think about this? Certainly,
it was on the record. How was it between sessions of the court?
It was after the between sessions where the jury was present. I apologize, Your Honor.
So Mr. Roberts would have been there if anything was going on the record, or the judge wouldn't have put anything on the record.
He would have been. However, Mr. Roberts was not. He didn't comment during this. There was no indication.
That's different than the suggestion that it took place out of the presence of the prosecutor.
Oh, I apologize if I suggested that. I did not intend to, obviously.
This statement made by the court in response to the inquiry, it would be, I think, difficult for the court not to find that a prior sexual offense is not probative of the charges that are here. Obviously, it's prejudicial, but I think when one is being charged with another sex offense, its probative value would outweigh any prejudice that would occur. First, is that accurate? Did the trial judge really say that?
I believe that's accurate.
And are you defending that?
I believe that it was a response to the fairly generalized and inaccurate statement given by counsel, that was the remarks that he made. I don't think it was necessarily the best tact to take. Perhaps the better course would have been submit to me what actually happened, the full basis of this. But again, these are precisely the issues that were the problem in Fennell and Walker. We don't know how this would have been relevant. And in those cases, they had actually gone through the whole discussion of what the prior offenses were, what the purpose they would be able to be used, And because he didn't testify, because these two defendants didn't testify, they didn't get to review that now. Here,
so you're telling us that the it was the obligation of defense counsel once the judge made this advisory ruling to insist that the state make an offer of proof and that there be a full record of what the evidence would be. Is that correct?
That would have been one way. The tact I would suggest it would be to follow what happened in Walker and Fennell and do it ahead of trial, before the day before your client is supposed to testify.
But, I mean, if, assuming that had not occurred.
The suggestion that the state would be making today would be present the trial judge with, if you want to do it in this manner, present the trial judge with the full set of facts and circumstances necessary to make the decision. Here, the representation of counsel was that the first cited the standard of 403, not any of the other standards. That one is going to be a probative versus prejudice type of analysis. And the representation of the prior offense was also inaccurate. He represented that it was a relationship with a girl that was underage but not known until later, but for age it would have been consent.
Well, the concern, though, is what the state was going to do. Anyone who was going to represent what the scenario would be for the purpose of the judge making a decision would have to be the state. The issue isn't what defense counsel speculates the state might do. The issue is what is the state going to do if the defendant testifies? Are they going to ask him, have you ever been convicted of X, to which his response can be yes, and then that ends it? Or, as the trial judge suggested here, they'll be able to say, you were convicted of X, and wasn't that a sexual offense, and weren't the circumstances of that offense the following for the purpose of convincing the jury that if you've done that in the past, you're probably guilty of doing it now? That's what the defense attorney wanted to know about ahead of time. Are we going to play by the rules here, or am I going to get sandbagged by the state? And the trial judge's response is, you know, what me worry? You may get sandbagged, you may not, but you could get sandbagged because it's logical that you would be. What kind of response is that?
As I said, Your Honor, it's perhaps not the best response. However, this is, again, precisely the concern that we had in Walker and Fennell.
Well, how is the defense counsel going to tell the judge what the state's planning to do?
Well, first, it would be to present it in the proper form. Present what they are concerned about, as they did in Fennell. We're concerned that the state may use this against us. Here, the prosecutor informed Mr. Daly's counsel of the prior offense, did not indicate one way or another whether he would use it. The way to get to this decision is to place it in the proper procedural context for the court. Give them the full set of facts. I want to make sure that my client can't be prejudiced by this. Here's the full circumstances. State respond. The state's response could have been, we don't intend to use it. And, again, that's what this court has recognized. The state may elect not to.
You have the defense attorney turn to the prosecutor and say, state respond?
If he had filed a motion in limine with what he sought to prohibit the state from using, the state would have been obligated.
Motion in limine is routinely oral. They're not all pretrial written motions.
Certainly not.
Things come up in the course of trial, and trial counsel is forced on stand up on their own two feet and come up with an oral motion in limine because there's no time for anything else. That happens all the time, doesn't it?
That's true, Your Honor.
Perfectly appropriate.
It is. However, this was something that could have been seen a mile away. This was not something that came up in the midst of trial. This was a prior conviction from 5 years before that he was well aware of before trial, that his client was well aware of before trial, that could have been presented to the court in a manner that the court would have deemed necessary to get the state.
But for the court's ruling, as a matter of law, would there have been any circumstance under which the state, if he had answered, yes, I was convicted of that offense, had put before the jury any of the factual circumstances concerning that earlier offense?
I don't know, Your Honor. With all due candor, I do not know what the circumstances of that would have been. I know only the generalized facts of the prior conviction.
It's not a crime of dishonesty, right?
No, it's not.
So why is it going to come in?
Well, for instance, if Mr. Daly had gotten on the stand and said, I've never had sex with an underage girl, admittedly would be a very dumb statement. Certainly it would be.
Unless it were true.
It's not. He admitted his behavior in the prior case, both to police officers and to the court. If he had made that statement, it certainly would have been worthy of impeachment. You were convicted of unlawful sexual intercourse third in 2000, isn't that correct? Certainly that would have been a useful line of inquiry that would have been fully admissible under all the rules.
But that would be something that he would open the door to.
Yes, which again...
But if he doesn't open the door to his past criminal history, it wouldn't come in.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Would it?
I cannot envision all circumstances. I would say, off the cuff, it probably would not. I would agree with Your Honor. And again, that's, once again, the circumstances of Walker and Fennell. We need to know what he's going to say to know whether this decision was correct. And we don't know what he was going to say.
That's not what the trial judge said.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that, and the state would suggest, that the way it was presented to the court was not sufficient to warrant the inquiry they're seeking.
Well, but the record does show he was going to testify. And so he just wanted to know, if I testify, does that fact in and of itself subject me to be questioned about this prior offense? And the judge seemed to indicate, yes, it does. So under that scenario, he could have testified simply denying the facts of this and nothing else. But the fact that he took the stand was going to subject him to impeachment on this prior offense. Isn't that a fair reading of the record?
It's based on what the judge said. It's possible. However, the state had not indicated whether it was going to attempt to use it. There was a question of whether the judge can reconsider his ruling before the state had an opportunity to cross-examine the witness. There were all of the concerns, again, in Walker and Fennell, as whether the circumstances can change after the defendant had already testified. There's certainly numerous opportunities to reconsider the decision, especially in light of the full circumstances and facts of his prior conviction. Now, moving to the third argument, which unfortunately Mr. O'Donnell did not get to, the shifting the burden argument. At least 10 times during both the cross-examination of the state's witnesses and the examination of the defense witnesses, the defense attempted to lay out a case of retaliatory reporting by the mother on behalf of the daughter. This took the tact of Vivian Roan, the defendant's mother, and the defendant taking the victim to first a Dr. Yedzani, then, according to Ms. Roan, and the first fact is not contested. There is a report in the record that, indeed, Ms. Roan did take the victim to Dr. Yedzani. According to Ms. Roan, Dr. Yedzani said, take her to A.I. DuPont. According to Ms. Roan, she did that. She also took the victim to Children and Families First, also called a specific DFS worker, Anthony Michael. The state, in rebuttal, called representatives from each of these agencies, the medical director of A.I. DuPont, who testified that there was no evidence that the victim had ever been seen there, the director of clinical and prevention services for Children and Families First, that there was no record of that, and Anthony Michael himself, who testified not only would he never have a conversation like that with Ms. Roan described it as, we were having another conversation and I mentioned that my granddaughter had been abused by her brothers. Not only would he never have a conversation like that, but had no record of it and would have a duty to report it. These things were all legitimate rebuttal. In the state's brief, we cite a case from the First Circuit, United States v. Roberts, where the court ruled that by positing a defense theory of the case, they had opened the door to this entire line of inquiry. Here it was not commenting on evidence that was not in the record. There was very clearly evidence in the record that there was no evidence that she had ever gone there. This isn't suggesting that Mr. Daly had a burden to prove it. The fact is it could not be proved because there were no records, and that was evidence in the record that was done to rebut their theory of the case. And if the court has no further questions, we'll rest on my brief.
Thank you, counsel. If there are any further inquiry to be made about 3513 or any other matter that came up during the questioning, we'll get back to you about it. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.